Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. This week's selections include special lockbox panels. The fund drive starts on Monday at 6 a.m., so show your support by donating and helping WAMC deliver the information you need. You can pledge anytime online at wamc.org. On Wednesday, October 9th, the special lockbox panel focused on climate change, and Joe was joined by Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, an advanced lead for the White House and former Chief of Staff for State Senator Michelle Hinchey, and former Assistant County Executive for Pat Ryan, Anna Markowitz, Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman, and best-selling author and a commentator on climate and energy issues, Jeff Goodell.
Hurricane Milton is ready to strike later today, and I want to talk about that. First, Jeff, give us a sense of you're in Asheville, when you arrived, what you're seeing, and kind of what you are experiencing at the moment.
Well, Joe, I just arrived yesterday, so I'm still kind of getting oriented. But what I'm seeing here is, the kind of dramatic devastation that I've seen in the aftermath of other hurricanes and tropical storms, and mixed with places where life is going on as usual. It's a very strange combination. But the drama of what's happened here is kind of at once pervasive and sort of startlingly obvious. Yesterday, I walked through the Arts District down on the French Broad River, which is sort of the kind of cultural hub of Asheville. And, it was just a giant pile of rubble. And there were people there picking through things and trying to save what they can, people rolling out. I saw one shop owner rolling out a bunch of hangers full of filthy, muddy clothes. I walked by a telephone pole that was wrapped, 60 feet high with wood pallets and twisted roofs and houses that have been moved off their moorings and kind of jumbled into other houses. It's a beautiful morning here. It's very strange, this feeling of this sort of, it's a fall day. It's really lovely, and yet there's sirens going off all around me right now. I'm about to head off into the mountains to look at some of the smaller towns that have been really devastated. I drove by the hospital a few minutes ago. The emergency services area was crowded with activity. So it's really, it's been a week, and it's still a big mess.
How much of the foreboding, if you will, or just the psychological cloud that is over the whole situation that another storm is bearing down on the southern part of the country?
Yeah, I think that that's not so much part of the consciousness here, because I think people are so, focused on trying to get the city and the state back up and running. But I think for people like me and you, and for a lot of our listeners, it's a very big deal. And for me, I've been covering climate change for 20 or 25 years, a very long time. And I've covered and been part of a number of hurricanes, and starting with Hurricane Sandy back in New York. And even for me, the fact that we had these two back-to-back hurricanes hitting in the same place, within weeks of each other, is to me kind of really emblematic of something that climate scientists and climate activists and people who've been watching this for a long time have been talking about, which is the amplification and acceleration of the impacts that we're seeing. That as our climate gets hotter and hotter, we are going to see these cascading impacts. We're going to see bigger, stronger, more destructive storms. We're going to see more extreme heat waves. We're going to see more extreme rainfall events like the ones that we had in Vermont last year that were so devastating. I mean, this is what climate change means as it accelerates. And it's, to me, what makes it kind of so terrifying and so urgent.
Are we talking about the right things right now? I mean, I know the it seems to be, especially where you are in North Carolina, the question is government response and getting things back together. And I know you're early into it, but where we are in that. But also, just then when we start saying, okay, we have this other storm coming, but at what point do we start thinking, okay, we have to change what we're doing to make this situation, to try to pull the plug on this situation from happening in the future?
Well, you know, I mean, we're certainly thinking about the right things in some ways, right? But there's been a big effort to cut emissions. The price of renewable energy has fallen dramatically in the last decade. There's more and more emphasis on adaptation and preparation for these extreme events. But the problem is that sort of Mother Nature is outpacing our efforts very dramatically. And these extreme events are happening faster and faster. And it's very clear that, you know, our world is built for a climate that no longer exists. And I think that's really important to understand, and the profundity of that, of thinking about that, that the climate that we live in now and that we're going to continue to live in is not the climate that our world was built to deal with. And that, so that implies everything from where we built real estate on the coast, the kinds of building codes we have, the kind of stormwater drainage systems we have, you know, on and on to things like the spread of diseases is very different as temperatures rise, how we protect ourselves from heat waves. So on one level, we're getting it, and there's a lot of progress. On another level, we haven't even come close to really grasping the scope and scale of the changes that are ahead of us.
Bob?
No, I'm in complete agreement. I think one thing that we're not spending a lot of time talking about, and we should, is things like 2004. I actually responded down with a team from Virginia to help with in Punta Gorda in Hillsborough for Storm Charlie that came in and was supposed to hit Tampa, went further south. It was the first time in, I think it was like 75 years, though, that they had a hit on the west side of Florida. And we're starting to see this on a regular basis, Joe. I mean, you know, one of the questions that was before the panel started that Dave and Sarah were talking about was how, you know, what are real life examples of climate change? And I think what's going on in the Gulf and the power of the hurricanes that are coming up the Gulf, the power of the marine heat wave and what it's doing to turbocharge these storms, it is going to make areas that are very desirable to live in fundamentally unsafe to live in. You know, I hope today we can talk about things like what is the expectation of government response and bailout in areas that we know are no longer livable. You know, what should be the posture of our response community. You know, I would like to talk a little bit about, you know, where FEMA should be in the pantheon of agencies, and how do we address something that I think was key in the earlier statements, is that we need to stop thinking that this is a temporary blip. We need to start to think about that this is the new normal, and how do we live with that?
Right. Anna?
I mean, I completely agree. I grew up across the street from a beach and with a marsh in my backyard. And during Sandy, a lot of my neighbors' houses flooded. And it's kind of part of the reason why I live in the mountains now. And this North Carolina hurricane really, I think, startled me in a way that other hurricanes haven't, because it made me think, oh, this isn't just a coastal problem. This is everywhere. This is, you know, climate change is really changing what we know about storms. It's meaning that places that weren't hit before can be, and it can, the flood risk can be almost as much as the wind risk. And so I think we really need to use this as a wake-up call to expedite all of our climate efforts. You know, now's the time.
Mark?
Joe, if you look at this problem not only domestically but internationally, and I'm interested what Jeff thinks about this, but I think it's pretty well decided amongst the most sober that the world is not going to meet its goals of constraining carbon emissions to the point where we're going to constrain global warming at 1.5 degrees centigrade. And I think it's time that the U.S. and the world admit that, which is not to say that we need to reduce our efforts at decreasing what we omit or even mitigating what we have omitted. But more importantly, in the short run, there are lots of things that we can do in this country and we can do internationally to start to protect people against the effects of the consequences of these storms and severe weather events. And frankly, it's time we admit that we're going to turn our homework in late and get on with protecting people from the consequences of that and reset our goals as to what we can do with restraining emissions and decide what the more realistic approach is to that problem as well.
Jeff, that's a great point. Let me ask you what you make of that, of resetting our goals. And first of all, do you agree with that? And second of all, what does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I've believed since, in fact, I wrote about it since in the Paris, at the Paris Agreement in 2015, when the 1.5C goal was first sort of proposed and announced, you know, that we may as well, you know, commit to, you know, writing to work on unicorns too. I mean, it was. To my mind, never really going to happen, and it's pretty clear now, I think, among the sober-minded, that it's not going to happen. But that doesn't mean that we don't need to continue to work really hard to stop, to cut emissions, because, you know, I think one of the things that people don't grasp is that, you know, all this stuff is the climate impacts that we're talking about are going to continue to get worse as long as we continue to emit emissions. And then once we get to this sort of mythical net zero, which we may, or, you know, there's an aspiration to reach by 2050, that is not going to restore the old climate back to the one that we all grew up in. All that is going to do is sort of stop the warming. So we are, you know, we have permanently created a new climate that is more extreme. And I would push back a little bit on the phrase the new normal. I think, you know, I think it's more like the new abnormal. I mean, the rules are different. The jet stream is wiggling in different ways. We don't know how fast the glaciers in West Antarctica are going to collapse. We don't know what's happening to the ocean conveyor belt in the Atlantic, which controls a lot of the weather in the Northern Hemisphere. There's a lot of uncertainties in how this is going to react. And so when we think about how we're going to prepare for this, you know, the question is, what are we preparing for? And that makes it all the more urgent and all the more important that we really think seriously about, you know, changing how we build our world and how we think about things like emergency preparedness and all the other things to make our lives more resilient and more rugged.
Go ahead, Bob.
You know, and Joe, we have to be prepared as a society that there's a cost associated with that. Take something like the building codes. We can build much more resilient communities. They are going to cost more money. They may not be as aesthetically pleasing. We may have to limit where we build. The idea of living on a beach, you know, I think about the pictures down in Hatteras, North Carolina, of the houses, you know, basically falling into the ocean. When we see the damage, the potential damage that we could see from Milton, that is, I think, potential to be absolutely catastrophic. It's going to cost more. Our critical infrastructure is going to have to be completely reworked. Something as simple as the ability to handle water runoff right now on a regular rainstorm, Miami floods because of the size of their stormwater systems aren't enough to handle. It's certainly not going to be enough to handle what the new patterns are doing to us. So all of this points towards a fundamental change in how we think about our built environment and honestly making some hard decisions about where we build. At some point in time, as a taxpayer, I need to push back and say, I appreciate the fact that you've got money and you want to live on the water and look out over the beautiful ocean. I'm not going to pay for that. And I'd be interested in some part of the discussion going to the idea of what's going to happen when the insurance pulls out of places like Florida and the coastal communities, because all of these things are going to have an enormous impact on our built environment, where we live, our communities, and our economy.
Jeff, let me ask you a question about some of the things that we were talking about before the break. And, you know, you think about these communities and you think about living along the coast of Florida, you think about living along the coast of North Carolina or South Carolina, and the inherent dangers. But what is it that then makes Asheville, North Carolina, such a spot that is the focal point of the devastation of that storm, which sort of would indicate to me that really no place is ultimately safe?
Well, I think that's very true. No place is ultimately safe. There is this notion that, you know, there's a safe haven that you can, you know, find a bubble to live in and where you will be safe from all these things we're talking about. And I, you know, I was just in Asheville 3 months ago driving around here with my wife. I live in Texas now, sadly left Saratoga Springs and live in the belly of the climate beast in Texas. And we were fleeing the extreme heat, and it was so hot in Austin that we said we had to get out of here. And so we decided to go to Asheville. And we were driving around, and I was saying, well, this would be a great place to be in the you know, superheated climate world. It's like got elevation, it's relatively cool, there's no oceans nearby, you know, to worry about sea level rise. It's a thriving economy. It's like some parts of upstate New York. It would seem like a very safe place. And yet, look what happened here, you know? And it really does underscore these risks that our entire kind of built infrastructure is much more fragile than we understand it to be. But before we go on, I want to just interject one other aspect of this, especially with the hurricane that's barreling into Florida right now. When we think about adapting and what we're going to do and how we're going to build or not build in these places, I have to remember, this is a monstrous storm that is coming into a state that is governed by a governor who has decided to ban the phrases climate change from any state documents or laws. You're not allowed to talk about climate change, basically, in Florida. And the state is, you know, by all, you know, indications, going to vote for a man who thinks that climate change is a hoax. I mean, so when we think about, like, adapting and we think about how we're going to deal with this in the big picture, the kind of political and culture war aspects of this are an enormous issue. It is just how do you think about changing, you know, where we build and building codes and all the complexities of flood insurance and all that when you have a governor who won't even say the phrase and you have people voting for a president who thinks it's all a hoax. And the first thing he wants to do when he gets in the office, he has said, is drill, baby, drill.
It is, go ahead, Mark.
Jeff, this is Mark, and being a banker, I have an answer. Unfortunately, it's a terrible answer, which is the markets will catch up with Florida eventually if they keep trying to live in Disney World. They're already facing a tremendous fiscal crisis with respect to the insurance that the state offers, and it's going to become untenable for the state to support people in the geographies where they currently reside with proper insurance. The bad news is you don't want to get to that situation in a society where the market's making the corrections, because those that suffer the most are those with the least means and the most vulnerable. So the good news is there is a backstop to all this, just like, frankly, there is to the national debt. But the bad news is if you let it get that bad before you start making policy corrections, you're disproportionately harming a disadvantaged group.
That was Mark Whitman on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, October 9th. Just a reminder that the fund drive will be in full swing on Monday morning starting at 6 a.m. You can donate anytime at WAMC.org. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, October 10th, the special Lockbox panel focused on LGBTQ+ issues, and Joe was joined by Associate Director of Intercultural Student Engagement at the University at Albany, Courtney D. Allard, Community Activist, former Executive Director of the New York State Office for the Prevention of Domestic Violence, Gwen Wright, Political Consultant, Lobbyist, Libby Post, Chief Executive Officer of In Our Own Voices, Tandra Legrone, MPA Senior Director of New York State Hate and Bias Prevention Unit at the Division of Human Rights, Ron Zaki, founder of Come Out Central New York, Kevin Bailey, and co-founder and executive director of Big Gay Hudson Valley, Stephen Hengst. In the time we have for this segment, we only hear from Courtney D. Allard, Gwen Wright, Libby Post, Tandra Legrone, and Ron Zaki.
This morning, we focus on LGBTQIA+ issues this election season. In recent years, LGBTQ rights have increasingly been used as political tools. In 2020, during the presidential election year, anti-trans legislation reached a record high with 118 bills introduced. By this year, that number has surged more than fivefold, 658 bills targeting bodily autonomy, healthcare access, sports participation, even the visibility of the LGBTQ community, particularly focusing on trans youth. At the same time, anti-trans conservatives continue to spread misinformation about gender-affirming care, fueling harmful rhetoric. As a result, 45 of these bills have become law across 16 states. As the 2024 election approaches, the fight for LGBTQ liberation is more critical and urgent than ever. On one hand, the LGBTQ community has gained increased invisibility, but this has also sparked what some describe as a backlash. For example, we saw this earlier this year. Brands like Target and Bud Light scaled back their Pride-themed merchandising after facing backlash for partnering with LGBTQ influencers. Over the next 2 hours, we will focus on this issue with a roster of 7 guests who will provide context, concerns, and information, and we are lucky enough to meet them all right now. Let me get to the group here and introduce them in fashion. We have 3 guests in the studio. We have 2 guests joining us remotely, and in case you don't know this, 5 guests is a lot of guests, but we need each and every one of you, so here we go. We welcome Courtney D. Allard, who is Associate Director of Intercultural Student Engagement at UAlbany. Hello, Courtney. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Really wonderful to have you on the program. Gwen Wright is here, community activist, former executive director of the New York State Office for the Prevention of Domestic Violence. Gwen, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
We also welcome Ron Zaki, Senior Director of the New York State Hate and Bias Prevention Unit at Division of Human Rights. Hello, Ron. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I am wonderful. Thank you very much for being with us. And Tandra Legrone is here, Chief Executive Officer of In Our Own Voices. Hello, Tandra. How are you?
I'm great this morning, and that's Tandra.
All right, it is Sandra. Now, you know, I just want you to know Ron told me that, but then I had from our production team, I had the phonetics, and I decided to trust them. I'm sorry, Ron, don't think any less of me, but I have to work with them every day, okay? All right. We also welcome Libby Post, who is had stepped out, but she'll be back, I assume, and a political consultant, lobbyist, and regular roundtable panelist. And again, we thank you all for being with us. So what I'd like to do as we first start and go around the in this first section before we go back to a little break with some fundraising is just get some thoughts from all of you as to where we are in these less than a month before the election of dealing with LGBTQ issues and the campaign. And ultimately, we don't have to get into the horse race of it, but I am interested in the concerns that you have and why this particular election is so important. Tandra, let's begin with you.
Sure. Good morning. So your first question is, what is kind of the temperature of what I'm seeing in the community?
Right.
I think folks are really at a place where I'm hearing that there is this uncertainty around safety is the number one kind of concern for folks, giving past kind of behaviors during elections. And so folks are really feeling uneasy. And of course, you know, what this election means for not only just the LGBTQ, particularly BIPOC individual, but women identified as well, is that, you know, we're folks are at a place where our rights and our human rights are on the line. We feel that tension that if the election does not go in kind of a democratic way, that we feel that women's rights, the right to choose what to do with your body, is on the line. LGBT rights, you know, we are over 600 LGBT anti-legislation bills so far that have been introduced, which is scary. TGNC, children, even, you know, children are are really feeling it. So we see a heightened sense of anxiety that folks are coming in our doors that are seeking not only individual counseling, but we're making space for folks to have conversations of this impact and what this impact may mean on group levels. And our doors are always open. But this is a scary time for people less than 30 days away. And so we are preparing the best way that we can. And what I mean by preparation, we're prepping for safety and what that means for our community, especially, you know, Interim Voices' house on Lark Street, which has a lot of traffic. And so we're just making sure we're going to try to be safe.
So on that, and looking at safety, let's go to Ron Zaki, Senior Director of New York State Hate and Bias Prevention Unit at Division of Human Rights. So I assume you're seeing what Tandra just described.
Yeah, you know, every time there's an incident, the last election, the previous administration federally, we saw upticks of hate and bias across the state. And we're anticipating, you know, that could happen again. But we hope not, you know, hopefully this can move in a positive way. You know, we've seen the difference between administrations. This administration on the state level has done so much to protect LGBTQIA plus New Yorkers and to continue that legacy of Stonewall, where LGBTQ people here in New York State have more rights and protections. And we've moved on to continue to fight for those protections and the equality, but also equity. And so, you know, hopefully we're moving in a different direction, but we're always prepared for whatever may come up.
talking this morning about these issues and the importance of this particular election coming up. We welcome Courtney D'Allard, who is Associate Director of Intercultural Student Engagement at UAlbany. So how is it going on campus?
Well, I mean, I think the students are really engaged, and that's a pretty powerful part about being on a campus that is creating spaces for education. So we have a lot of different opportunities for students to really engage in the areas they want to understand more, right? How do we, I mean, Rockefeller College doing a whole series of opportunities for students to get engaged in, and talk about, well, what does it mean for SCOTUS, right? What does it mean for the docket that would come up for the judges and for national campaigns.
Right.
So that's pretty powerful. It's powerful to be on a campus with a lot of active, aware, conscious students. You know, it's a microcosm of the larger community. Everything that exists in the world exists on that campus, and it's how we hold it together and how we bring people together and have conversations. So it's palpable in those ways because you've got students who are, putting out the vote. You've got students who are talking about LGBTQ issues. You've got students that are talking about Palestine and Israel. You've got students that are talking about, abortion and access and bodily autonomy, all that same stuff. And they really have a platform and a forum, not just to talk about the issues that they care about, but to talk across issues in a powerful way that they'll have to do their whole lives. So I love that, being able to do that work. And it doesn't mean it's not incredibly hard at times.
Gwen Wright, bring us to the community. How is it on the ground?
Well, I think that I would echo what's been said already and include the fact that Prop 1 in New York State has definitely brought some anti-LGBTQAI+ sentiment. And the concerns that are being raised are so outrageous that it's really scary. I mean, it's sort of like going back 4 years ago, one of the things that we saw happen during that last presidential election and following was an uptick in the number of LGBTQAI+ individuals who were elected to public office. Unfortunately, they've had some significant challenges within that forum. And so now what we're seeing is things that, you know, it's sort of like the things that people come up with, the antis come up with, is just outrageous when they say things like, you know, boys are going to be on girls' sports teams. Well, no, that's not accurate. Boys will not be on girls' sports teams. So a lot of targeting to transgender youth, which is really unfortunate and downright scary, and it's unfair. You know, someone said yesterday at a forum that I was up that it's not okay for adults to bully children at all, ever. And that's what we're seeing happening, is that adults are really bullying kids and making them feel less than. And I thought we were at a place in our political development where we encouraged and supported and welcomed all people to the table, and now we're seeing some significant pushback around that issue. So I think that on the ground, what we're seeing are people are sort of hiding behind their doors because they're afraid to step out. And now more than ever, we need all the voices at the table. And we do see some good coalitions going on. Prop 1 is one example, but there are some really good coalitions going on to support the way that we want to live here in America.
Libby.
Well, you know, going back to the George Bush presidential campaign, where marriage equality was made into the talking point and the boogeyman, and you know, we were targeted. We've always been the target once we all came out and we were much more part of the society, you know. Before, you know, in the 60s, 50s, 40s, we were all in the closet and, you know, just the whisper was enough to move the political needle. Now that many more of us are out, we're part of the community, we're elected officials, we're people at universities, we're doing all that, you know, we're there regardless. You know, we have always been since, I would say, 1969, since Stonewall, The best punching bag for the what is now the nationalist Christian right, and unfortunately for the Republican Party. And now we're seeing the results of all of this.
Why is that, Libby? Why is it been? Why do you think? I don't disagree with you, but why do you think you have been the punching bag and able to elicit such fear even to this point in this election year?
Just go to Leviticus 22. Okay, all you need to do is go to Leviticus 22.
I left it on the desk.
Right.
I'll check it out later.
Leviticus 22 says, man shall not lie with man as with a woman. The Bible also says you can't wear leather and linen together. You can't plant things next to each other, you know, that you can sell your daughter into slavery. All, you know, somebody should be stoned at the gates of the community, all this sort of stuff. But the Christian right, the Christian nationalists, focus on just Leviticus 22 because it makes us into the enemy of what they see as straight white Christian nation. And it's easy it was always easy to target us because many of us would just go back in the closet because of out of fear, you know. That's not happening as much now, but we have plenty of people who in southern states, in states where, you know, it's now illegal to provide trans care. It's, you know, it's still legal to fire people because we don't have a national non-discrimination act. People go back into the closet because they're fearful. And the Christian right plays on that fear, not just ours, but the fear of the other that they can then monopolize and use politically.
Tandra, talk a little bit about that fear and why you think it exists and what ultimately we can do about it and countering it.
Well, I think Libby just really laid it all out in a sense of why is it. But I think in combating it, one of the things that I remember when gay marriage got passed and the vote literally came down to Ron McDonald in Saratoga. That was the last holding out vote. And I mentioned this because he lost his seat because of that. And the fact of all of the pushback and what he had to endure afterwards. So to answer your question, to go back to your question, I just wanted to make mention of that. I think education is really, really, really the key, and making space and making safe spaces for people to have like conversations like this panel. You know, this is not every day, but I also want to bring to light that there's also this real strong resiliency in not only just like in New York State, and I travel all the way around the country, but I always can't wait to get back home. But there is also power in our gay voices, our collective LGBTQI voices. You know, I know, you know, in the Capital Region, and I don't know if Libby can also attest to this, is that you know, folks need to have that gay vote to be able to win election. Really, in the Capital Region, you need to have that gay vote. And so I'm hoping that I'm answering your question of kind of what can we do to combat it. And I think it is really the education wise, boots on the ground, allowing our allies to be able to be accomplices for us. They need to step up for us often and make space if it's safe for them to step up, but to make space for that and to organize ourselves and educate ourselves.
So last night, as I was watching the Philadelphia Phillies get destroyed by the New York Mets.
Oh, by the way, I'm just so, so,
I know.
So sorry.
I know. I'm the Phillies fan. But
go
look,
Mets.
I'll tell you this. Congratulations to the Mets. They were on fire. They've been on fire. And no one deserved to win that game more. So I'm done. Anyway, Oh my God, the ads, the political ads. Oh dear Lord. So I want to talk about this a little bit because these are from a PAC, and they are incessant. They run all the time. They are for the Trump campaign, and they are very anti-trans. They are very homophobic. There is a tagline in them that comes out and says Kamala is for them. President Trump is for you. It's airing all the time. Some of it, I believe, is AI generated. I don't know if that's the case or not. They have Kamala Harris saying that she is going to offer surgery to prisoners and every prisoner, and it doesn't sound right, but it doesn't even matter. It's just taken out of context. But anyway, I'm curious as to and Courtney, let's begin with you on this, of just what kind of damage an ad like that does, not just in a campaign of one candidate over another, but for an entire community.
I mean, this isn't new, right? Like the idea that there's like this focus on pronouns. When I watched that and I said they, them, and he's for you, I'm like, I'm also a you.
Yeah, that, there you go. Right. Yeah,
like a, we're all you. You are us. Anyway, right? Like this idea that this is a language or a campaign of fear. And so the way it's specifically targeting trans people, this isn't new. These are the same tropes. We're just regurgitating them to different groups. And we were talking about power just before the break. And I was thinking to myself in this idea about power, it's not just about LGBTQ plus people, right? It's about maintaining power. And you can plan, you know, there's a guy and a girl and they get married and that's the thing. You can plan for that. But gay and lesbian people have always challenged that that's the only structure of power, right? Gay men, lesbian women. And so because they challenge that gender structure and trans people challenge that gender structure, we become the target because we disrupt the opportunity of that. And so like that kind of fear campaign just plagues on people's misunderstandings, non-information, the misinformation that we put in schools for so long, and unfortunately continues to silence and make trans and non-binary people extra afraid of being who they are, especially young people who are seeing those campaigns.
That was Courtney D. Allard on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, October 10th. Once again, the fund drive is starting bright and early on Monday morning at 6 a.m. You can donate anytime at wamc.org. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, October 11th, Joe was joined by the Ulster County Comptroller and the former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, corporate attorney with Phillips Lytle, LLP, Rich Honan, and Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan.
All right, let's move on and go to another topic, and that is the GOP Senate leads. This is something that came out yesterday, and I wanted to get to from the New York Times and Siena College's polling. The latest polling shows that Republicans are leading in key Senate races in Montana, Texas, and Florida. That creates the headline in the New York Times: Republicans appear poised to take control of the Senate, according to these new poll numbers.
Control of the Senate appears likely to flip from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party this fall as one of the nation's most endangered Democrats, Senator John Tester of Montana, trails his Republican challenge in his bid for re-election. Mr. Tester, who first won election to the Senate in 2006, is winning over moderate and independent voters and running far ahead of the Democrat at the top of the ticket, Vice President Kamala Harris. But as of now, that does not appear to be enough to survive in Montana, a conservative state where former President Donald Trump is ahead by 17 percentage points and where control of the Senate hangs in the balance. Tim Sheehy, a wealthy Republican businessman and a former Navy SEAL who has never held public office, leads Mr. Tester 52-44%, according to the poll. At least seven other Democratic-held Senate seats are competitive this fall, including the presidential battlegrounds of Arizona, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Nevada, and Wisconsin. In late September, a series of surveys in four of those races, as well as in Ohio, found Democrats ahead, though narrowly in some cases. The problem is that the Democratic Party has scarce opportunities to flip any Republican-held seats in 2024 to make up for any potential losses, such as in Montana. Mayor Sheehan.
Well, there you go. You know, I think that this is going to be a close race all along the ticket.
Right.
So I think that voter turnout is going to be critically important. And I think it's very difficult when you get down to these Senate races where there is a much more local, hyper-local fixation on who people are going to vote for. They might vote for Harris at the top of the ticket, but the Republican for the Senate. And it is going to impact the Supreme Court. I mean, that's ultimately what hangs in the balance. If there is an opening on the Supreme Court and Harris does win the presidency, I think we will have 4 years of an inability to fill that Supreme Court vacancy unless it's somebody who shares the extreme far right views that that we've seen as that court has shifted.
Rich?
Oh, I was going to defer to March, but what I can't tell in these races is how much of this is, I'll call it local, how much of this is statewide and based on that particular candidate, mm-hmm. versus who's at the top of the ticket. I think this year it's harder than ever to tell. Do the presidential candidates have coattails? Do they have reverse coattails? You know, I don't know. You know, Trump certainly has proven that getting his endorsement isn't always the path to getting into office, right? You know, I think Trump has taken some races that where a Republican would have won, and then Trump gets involved and, you know, picks and, you know, uses his influence to get an extreme candidate, and the Republicans end up losing. So I can't tell how much of this is a referendum on the national scene and how much of it is kind of issue by issue, person by person. The other thing I will say is, Mayor, you're right. It's all about turnout, which kind of makes me there's been a spate of stories about how the Democrats are starting to feel some trouble and we have to get people out. And, you know, when this becomes a headline in the New York Times, which some of us feel is really kind of just an arm of the Democratic Party, I think it's more of a clarion call to try and let's get out the vote before bad things happen. So I think this is a get out the vote effort by the Times.
It's interesting you say that because, you know, I looked around at some other polling and some other predictions and, you know, Cook has a different perspective. 270 to win has a different perspective. They're kind of calling it a 51-49 in the Democrats' favor.
Yeah.
But, you know, Kamala Harris has a very big unfavorability rating in Montana of like 60%, which I think is really challenging to overcome. And I saw that $265 million is expected to be spent in Montana. I thought, wow, that's a huge number. And then I divided it by the population. I'm like, oh, it's only $241 a person. It's not really that much in terms of advertising in the Senate races. And then I thought it was also interesting that in a bunch of the other swing states, or you know, states that will be challenging for the Democrats in the Senate, Texas, Florida, and Montana, Trump actually leads the Senate candidates in those states. So, you know, I think that, you know, it's hard for somebody like Kamala Harris to focus their energy on a Montana state when she knows that she's not going to win it for the presidential, yet she might lose that for the Senate. So, you know, how do you divide your resources and how do you focus on the things that matter most? But given some of these other prediction services, you know, maybe what you're saying is true, Rich, that the Times is calling something a little bit more dire than it might be from other sources. And it was interesting, you know, every time I see polling, I'm like, well, they're not polling millennials and Gen Z and they're not polling cell phones. No, this was everyone, like the majority of people reached in that poll in the New York Times that they were talking about was on a cell phone. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. It was a Siena poll, right?
Yes, it was CNN, New York Times.
I think it is. You know, the polling now, it's still fiendishly difficult, and I don't know that people even tell the truth anymore when they're talking to pollsters. But I do think that when you look at the impacts, for example, in North Carolina, to fill out an absentee ballot, it has to be notarized or have two witnesses.
Yeah, right.
Think about that. So that is going to really impact what's happening in North Carolina and the GOTV for both parties,
Yeah, right.
Because you now have thousands and thousands of voters who their polling places no longer exist, right? And so, you know, looking in Florida, looking in some of these other states that have been impacted. And so it's the combination of voter turnout, voter suppression, and active voter suppression that is happening, you know, across the country, people getting misinformation. We went and knocked on doors in Pennsylvania. I went with a group of people outside of Scranton, and there was a woman who had received a message that said that she couldn't vote because she was an independent. So knocked on the door, asked her if she was voting in the presidential election, and she said, no, I'm not allowed to vote because I'm an independent. So having to educate her.
Right.
Now, somebody sent her that message, right? So this is the type of...
Or somebody sent somebody that message.
Right.
Yeah. And who passed it on.
Right, somebody posted something about it, whatever.
Right, exactly.
However
right.
that, the nexus of that, who knows? But that's the type of, I think, hard work that I'm hopeful that given the ground game that the Democrats have, and I know the Republicans have a ground game too, but that getting people to the poll, having them not be afraid that they're going to get challenged at the poll, and there are some states where people will walk in and there will be somebody standing there and saying they can't vote. These are the types of things that I think are hurting the fabric not only of our democracy but of our community, right? Where at least we felt like, okay, you know, we have an election and your guy won, my guy lost, but like we're still going to say hi to each other on the street and, you know, we might grab a cup of coffee together. It's not, but that fabric gets torn at every time we see these efforts to suppress the vote.
It's hard to think even though the Democratic Party as a whole would look at Montana and say, oh, we got a good shot at winning this.
Well, hasn't Tester been, he's kind of been in the I don't want to say the gun sights.
It is Montana. Go ahead.
He's a pretty right-leaning Democrat. I mean, he's a very moderate Democrat.
Well you got to be right for there. But he's kind of been mentioned as kind of the shaky for you know for this upcoming cycle. But and then the other thing is, you know, the Democrats are going to take the House, right? So you know you're kind of back to where you are. You're still going to have. It sounds like you're probably going to have a split.
Yeah.
You know.
Mayor, I know you have to go and swear somebody in, right? So I go do all that mayor stuff. That's so cool. Before you go, let me ask you about the mayor, about the budget of this city and how that is looking. You have released it. What is the state now, and where do we go from here?
So we are in the process of the Common Council's review of that budget. They've been holding hearings on a regular basis. They bring in in the various departments and ask them questions about the budget. The public has the opportunity to either watch that online or attend in person. There will be public hearings where the public will have the opportunity to opine on the budget. And I typically will get a request that typically is in the form of a budget memo that the council will send asking for certain changes to the budget, for us to take a look at certain areas of the budget. And historically, we've been able to work those out and get to a budget hopefully by the first or second week in November.
What's the vibe?
The vibe?
Yeah. Meaning,
well, look,
you
nobody,
set it out and then
yeah, look, no,
nobody's like, yay, I got everything I wanted.
No, look, I think that we have funded the policies that the council has been asking for. We're continuing to invest in traffic calming, in pedestrian safety. We're continuing to invest in our parks, building the new Lincoln Park pool, our new community centers. We're continuing to invest in our street treatment program that we're doing with Albany County that is providing navigators out into the community where people are who are struggling. And we've made hundreds of connections, and they've been successful in connecting people with housing. And so this continues to fund that work. The one caveat for that is that if the council asked me to spend $1 million more on that, I couldn't, because we can't find the people to do the work. And so I would love to spend more money on it. And if there is an opportunity to do that, we will. But we're really struggling to find people. It's very, very challenging and difficult work. So I think nobody likes when taxes go up, but we didn't raise taxes for probably the first 5 years that I was mayor. And I think that that did put us at a little bit of a disadvantage. You know, with a 2% tax cap, you can't raise taxes by much anyway. But that it's really unrealistic. I mean, you think about your home budget and, you know, your ability to continue to balance your home budget without, you know, getting a raise or getting a second job, you know, finding additional revenue. So we did raise taxes within the cap. And, you know, that it's going to have various impacts, because we also did a revaluation. So actually our tax rate went down. But if the value of your property went up significantly, it's all going to kind of come out in the wash. We're saying that average homeowner isn't going to see much of an increase at all. Many will see a decrease, but there will be some who will be paying a few hundred dollars more, up to a few hundred dollars more in taxes next year.
And they might have been paying a lot more if it weren't for certain revenues. I was kind of surprised to see the school zone ticket, speeding ticket technology is expected to bring in substantial revenues, like something like $4 million. And I was thinking, ooh, I wish we had that.
Well, I wish that it wasn't, because I wish that we were not seeing that speeding. I have to tell you that we have three camera zones now that are actually live for ticketing. It's no longer in the grace period phase. And the number of tickets that are being issued is astounding. And somewhere upwards of a significant percentage of those cars exceeding 40 miles an hour. We have one car going 61 miles an hour in a school zone.
We just went to 25 miles an hour in the city of Kingston.
Well, yeah, we're switching to 25 miles an hour beginning January 1. So we want people to slow down. You know, this is really a critically important issue. And so what happened in New York City is that there was a big spike in revenue and then it fell off. No. And so, we still have to count it.
It's kind of like a one-time revenue,
right,
as people get
so
used to it.
So I would anticipate that next year, I would hope that we'll get compliance and that next year's budget, we'll see a shift in that.
Yeah. So that's a program where a win is decreasing revenue over time.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, people are cynical about that, but that is the reality. And it's what happened with our red light cameras. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've seen a significant amount of compliance, and that's the benefit of this. You know, I will say 2/3 of the vehicles that have been that will be issued tickets based on this week's activity are from registered outside the city of Albany. So, you know, if you're coming in and you're commuting, just chill. You know, listen to WAMC.
That was Kathy Sheehan on the Roundtable panel on Friday, October 11th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at WAMC.org/roundtable. The fun drive will officially begin when the sun comes up on Monday morning at 6 a.m. Please show your support to the station and help us deliver the news you need by donating anytime at WAMC.org. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.